Welcome back to the Star of Rock Murders. I'm your host, Andy Hale. I've got Whitney Bronwith here with me. Whitney, it's so good to see you. A lot to talk about today.
I am so excited. Lay it on me. I'm ready. Tell me what you have to share.
What's funny is people don't really realize this. They probably think, like, you know, we go through an outline and stuff. Most times, Whitney has no idea what we're going to talk about. hit record and I just like, okay, what am I going to drop on Whitney today?
Yeah, I mean, but I think it makes it particularly enjoyable for me because I was eating my breakfast this morning going, oh gosh, what new discovery has there been since the 48 hours since I've talked to Andy? So
yeah, no, I love it to get your kind of natural raw reaction. So this is what I want to talk about. The genetic genealogy results. We have formally disclosed the names of the brothers who that hair belongs to one of these three brothers. Okay. I'm going to talk about that with you. But I want to first set the table because I really want to slow walk this and explain to people why this really is the checkmate, in my opinion. Like this is literally the checkmate now. It's game over. This result alone. Put aside the other 100 things we have, but let me explain. Okay. This hair, as we've talked about, was found on the tip of the glove of Frances Murphy. Okay. That was also the finger where her fingertip was cut off. Okay. All right. Let's pause there. Let's just address the argument that it could just be a random hair that was there. Okay. Let's say she took a walk and that hair was on the tip of her glove. Does anyone really think that after the violent struggle she went through, the violent beating she undertook, this poor woman, being dragged into a cave, that hair, that little hair that just happened to blow onto her finger, would still be there after all that? No. And let me continue. Okay. But that's just one little point, which I don't even need to bring up. I'm looking, and I'm going to post this on the podcast website. I'm looking at a Dispatch Moline, Illinois article from April 19th, 1960. And it said 8 strands of blonde hair were discovered clinging to a glove worn by Frances Murphy. The hair samples came from males. 8 strands, okay? So it wasn't some random one solo hair. There's 8 strands, okay? Which tells you something. And then I think here's the most important part. And I'm going to post this on the podcast website too. It's an email from a person at Bode Technology, you know, the lab that did the DNA testing. And I asked her about that hair that they tested for DNA. And she said it was inventoried as hair 5, apparent root end. And then she said, quote, the serologist here at Bode described it in the inventory as having follicular material. Okay. So my point is, this is a hair with a root and basically cell matter on it. So it is not like a hair that when you get out of the shower and it's laying at the bottom of the bathtub that just fell out of your head. There's not a root on it. There's not follicular material on it. This is the exact reason we got a DNA result and we got genetic genealogy results, because the hair had a root. Okay. So the notion that it's some random hair, it is not. This is consistent with it being yanked out. And I don't think there is any legitimate, non-suspicious purpose how this hair got there, other than this person was involved in these killings. What do you have to say about all of that?
So, I mean, I want to reiterate this point as well. It's like, if you think about it, you know, you're brushing your hair. Next time you're brushing your hair, pull the hair out of the hairbrush and look at it. And it's... you're not going to see a little tiny turnip bulb at the end, right? What hair that you shed has a different profile. This I can only imagine it's got eight strands of hair, mind you, were found, but it's a strand of hair that has skin and a root attached to it. So I just picture Frances Murphy in the struggle for her life that unfortunately she lost, yanking from the perpetrator's scalp. She yanks, she gets these 8 strands in her hair, and then they violently cut off her finger after she's dead. And one of those hairs, the one that's been tested, embeds in the congealed blood in her hand. And I cannot, right, if we play that scenario back, that has to be how it happened. It could not have been a hair that a bird picked up for their nest and then dropped mid-flight and it fell and landed in her fingertip. as she lay dying, right? It that doesn't make sense. It just doesn't.
So, I mean, that's the foundation. I want people to understand this, that there is no, if somebody wants to argue this isn't important, how did the hair get there? There is no, like we said, there is no legitimate argument to be made that hair was not connected to the murders. It was, for those reasons. And I want people to understand that moving forward. That is really important. So we filed our response to the state's motion to dismiss our post-conviction petition. We talked about our newly discovered evidence in there, one of which is the genetic genealogy results. So to recap for people, a lot of people probably know this, but if there's some new listeners, that hair was first sent to Bode Technology for DNA testing. It came back as a male profile. Chester Uyghur was not the contributor. We put it into the state of Illinois DNA database. There was no match. Not a surprise. They didn't start collecting DNA probably until close to the year 2000. So this crime happened in 1960. But that's when we went to Othram, this cutting edge, the best company. They're in Texas. Cutting edge technology, genetic genealogy. Bode sent the hair to them. They got a genetic profile, again, because there's a root on it. They got a genetic profile, then they built out a genealogy database, and they've now determined that hair belongs to one of three brothers. And we disclosed this in our court filing that we filed last Friday. The three brothers they were all local to Utica back then. Leo Bray, who was born in 1892, died in 1972. Charles Bray, born in 1894, died in 1981. And Edward Bray, born in 1900, died in 1960. The reason they can't take it any farther to identify exactly which one is, Charles and Edward did not have children. The descendants of Leo, who could provide DNA samples to exclude Leo, have declined to do so. So we're kind of at the end of the road. It's one of those three brothers. The only other way to know for sure is to exhume a body. So I think the most likely candidate is Edward Bray, who would have been 60 years old at the time of the murders. And what's interesting is, according to his obituary, he died on March 16th, 1960, the day the women's bodies were found. I'm going to post this on the podcast website. I'll read you this first paragraph of the obit. Edward Shack Bray, 60, was found dead at 8 a.m. Wednesday in the snowplow truck at the General Service Plant at Seneca, where he was employed as a night guard for the last 15 years. He was found slumped over the steering wheel. An inquest was held, and the death was due to a coronary occlusion. So what do you make of all that, Whitney?
So I've been researching this to me, I mean, I think, okay, it's very telling. If we go back and we do the math here, he is found, you said, at 8 a.m., according to the obit, on the morning of March 16th. So his body was literally found prior to finding the women's bodies out at Starved Rock. So, you know, when you initially had told me the names of these potential candidates as suspects, and I started going back through all our FOIAs and, you know, trying to find reference to them, I found no mention of the name Bray. And that really puzzled me. But then finding this obit, now we know why. He's dead. There'd be no questioning. There'd be no consideration of him. And I also find it quite interesting that he's a 60-year-old man who, if you kind of dig a little bit deeper, had been a World War I veteran, had served with the artillery in the trenches in World War I, comes back and leads a very, very quiet life, working predominantly as a night watchman at a munitions plant, at the shipyards. And this is because it maybe sounds silly, but if I'm writing this Scorsese screenplay and I'm trying to create a character that doesn't have ties, doesn't have connections, that lives sort of a shadowy life associated with figures in the central Illinois Valley that are power players, I pick the night watchman at the shipyards. I do. And so for me, he feels to be the strongest candidate of those three brothers.
And here's the thing. I don't know anything about this guy's history. You know, I don't know who he was hanging around with, who he knew back then. I'm hoping that when all this, you know, people locally, I think this has been in the paper, they already know these names. I'm hoping anybody hearing out there might hear this and give us more information. Who were these Bray brothers? Who was Edward Bray? Who did he hang around with? What do you know about him? Tell me more. But we know his hair is found on Francis Murphy. That's what we know. And here's another huge point. These Bray brothers have no connection to Chester Weaker. None. None. Okay. So people out there that want to like change this story, you know, they want to change the story now and claim, oh, maybe Chester did it with other people. No. Chester didn't do it with any of the Brays. He doesn't know these guys. They're three times his age. Edward Bray was involved. Why? We don't know. I've always said it's multiple people, several people. I still think it's consistent with what we've said. He could have been recruited by Smokey Rona or somebody else to be part of this crew, a local person. I don't think there's anything at all inconsistent about this. I think it is consistent with what we said. And again, it totally exonerates Chester Weaker when you know this hair came from one of the killers. I mean, it's just to me that's anybody not recognizing that, like Will County's not, you know, their brief, which I'll also post on the podcast website, their motion to dismiss, you know, they try to just completely downplay this. They say, defendant relies on one hair found on the tip of Miss Murphy's glove that does not match his as the primary evidence of his innocence. They just try to diminish that. Like, yeah, it's one exonerating DNA result. Like, yes, that's all we need.
Andy, I feel like it's going to get to the point where you're going to be like, we have video surveillance that shows someone that isn't Chester committing the crimes. And then they're going to come back and say, well, maybe it's somebody who has shape-shifting technologies who was able to make themselves not look like Chester. Maybe it is Chester Weaker and he just morphed into another person. Like, I feel like whatever you're going to give is going to somehow be reinterpreted by the county to have some sort of bizarre, plausible explanation for why it doesn't fit. I have to admit my own ignorance and bias here that I led into it. I was always, always, always searching, Andy, in all the years we've been working on this, for someone between the ages of like 18 and 35, because, you know, we know statistically most violent crimes are perfpetrated by young men, but I didn't even think about kind of expanding the population pool up to a man who's in his 60s, but it actually makes a lot of sense to me. If there was someone who trusted, well, how many 60-year-old men could kill you with their bare hands? I know a lot. It's a lot of very strong 60-year-old men. It's not so that I take that out of the equation. I just in my mind was following the statistical pattern of like, it's typically young men that do violent crimes. But if this is a insider job, it also makes a ton of sense to have somebody that's maybe a trusted known entity.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
There to make sure it's done and done properly and not by young men who might mess
up. For all we know, he was the oldest guy there and there were younger people there. I mean, what we know is there's a Bray brother hair there on the tip of Mrs. Murphy's glove. That's a fact. And it's got a root and it's got cell material. That is a fact. Okay. And I'll post the Othram report on the podcast website. And by the way, Othram is this, you know, there's no argument. They are the top people doing this. As I said on a prior podcast, they've worked with Will County's coroner's office doing genealogy results on like Jane and John Doe's, identifying, you know, bodies that have been unidentified up till now. I mean, they are top of the line experts. There's no argument that, you know, they don't know what they're doing. They are the best of the best. And so I want to read you, somebody shared this with me just this morning. This is the kind of stuff we're dealing with, Whitney. It's a Facebook post. I won't say who it's from. But let me read it. For those of you who read the article in the news trib about the three gentlemen, they failed to mention that one was born in 1900, the other two in the 1800s. It is unbelievable they are so stupid as to think that men in their 60s would want to do something like that and have the energy to do it. One actually died that year, going for the money, no doubt. Okay. All right. This old timer. And I think, by the way, I found out the person who posted this, I think his daughter married one of the Brays. So I don't think he's one of the most unbiased persons out there. But
well, I'm about to point a finger and say that's just straight up ageism, because I'm sorry. There are no shortage of men in their 60s with the physical strength to commit a crime. I mean, that's just ridiculous ageism.
let's be clear, there's weapons used. I mean, you know, yeah. I mean, there's a baseball bat, a tire iron, whatever you want to, you know, some of the likely candidates. There's weapons used and there's multiple people, I'm sure. But my point is, a post like that, they act like you and I are just sleuthing and we've just come up with these names out of the blue. Like we don't even have a genetic genealogy hair result. We're just saying, hey, what about those Bray brothers? You know what? I think they might have done it. Like they act like we're just implicating people based on nothing, and they don't address that there's a freaking hair found on her finger with a root.
Well, and also that he also says, and one of them died that year. Yes, one of them died.
Yeah.
That year was found the same day as the women. Like that, just mysteriously, a man who was otherwise in you know, not in questionable health is just found slumped over his snowplow the same day that the women are found. And so I think that's really minimizing it to say he was found that year. No, he was found the day. He was found the day of.
And, you know, here's the thing. When you take this, which this alone in any other jurisdiction, in my opinion, the case gets vacated. In Cook County, this case would have been over long ago. Will County, you know, is ignoring this exonerating genetic genealogy result and all the other stuff we've got, the other 100 things we've talked about in this podcast. It is just an outrage to me that we're still fighting this, that we're basically, it's like a little kid with, you know, their hands over there is saying, I can't hear you. I can't hear you. I can't hear you. You know, it just doesn't matter. But this alone, I just cannot stress enough how significant this hair result is and what it means and what it proves. It is checkmate, period.
So let me ask you this, and I, you know, answer if you can, but I, you know, every time I go to a dinner party, somebody who's listening to the podcast comes up and talks to me and says, why are they, why is the county fighting this hard? What motives could you pin down that would explain why they are so resistant to this evidence?
That's a good question. I don't know. In my personal opinion, you know, there could be political reasons, not wanting to look, you know, like you let this person out, this triple murderer. I think there's also a recognition that, you know, there's a big financial liability awaiting. And I also think, you know, when I brought my motion to, do you remember I filed that motion to appoint a new special prosecutor when I alleged that Will County wasn't doing their job? I cited a Law Review article that just talked about an inherent conflict of interest that state's attorneys have. There's just like a bias. There's like an inherent bias of acknowledging mistakes made in a prosecution, even though this wasn't on their watch. It's not their office. It was a really good article just talking about all the inherent biases that state's attorneys and prosecutors have in reviewing potential wrongful convictions. And I think that comes into play too. I just think it's, again, I think it's indefensible to ignore all this evidence, but only Will County knows. Maybe we'll find out someday. I hope we will. I had another thing I wanted to share with you. I thought this was super interesting. I got two more points I want to make. We had a podcast listener actually go to look at some of the local papers that were not digitized. So they weren't on newspapers.com. And they came up with an article. This is May 26, 1960 in the Chicago Daily News. Okay, Chicago Daily News was not digitized, but it was a Chicago Daily paper along with the Tribune back in the 1960. All right, so it's just like 10 days after the women's bodies were found. And the title is, and I'll post this on the podcast website, Rewards Hindering Probers. And what it says in here, let me find the part I want to read. It talks about how a reward can actually be counterproductive. It talks about how you can get territorial and you don't share information like with your colleagues because you're just trying to like solve it yourself. But here's the stunning part. It says, most investigators, of course, try their darndest to find a crazy killer of the Starved Rock type. They work night and day as they're doing here. And this part of the article is in bold. And yet, one deputy sheriff was heard to say callously, quote, I'd frame a guy for $35,000, end of quote. Was he kidding? Maybe, maybe not. Who does that sound like, Whitney?
Oh, wow. Somebody was in the room when Dummett was talking?
Yeah, Deputy Dummett. I have heard so many bad things about this guy. I'm learning more and more about this guy. I had no idea the extent of his corruption. Can you believe that? We got the reward. He got reward money?
He did get that. And he did. Yeah, he ultimately got at least part of it, right? He got part of that reward money.
I'm looking at the reward money. Harlan Warren got the most. He got 11,000 and change. But Dummett, Hess, and Polygraph Examiner Kindig all got 5,500 each.
Which in 1960 is a lot of money, is a lot more. I mean, $5,000 now is no small chunk of change, but deflate it back to 1961 when they actually received it. And that's in central Illinois, that's a pretty big deal.
Let me read that quote one more time. Let me just read that again.
Please do.
And one deputy sheriff was heard to say callously, quote, "I'd frame a guy for 35 grand," end of quote. That just blew my mind. I mean, and now that I couple that with the reward money, and what I know about Dummett. And then this same person found another article about Dummett pre-1960. And it was titled "Holiday Pins Burglary on Companions." And it talks about this guy getting arrested for burglary. And he says in here, he testified he also feared mistreatment from Dummett because he had a bad reputation in regard to handling prisoners. I mean, like... And we've already posted in our brief, I posted like three other examples of where Dummett had crazy misconduct. You know, there was a case where a guy claimed that Dummett tried to get him to confess by showing him these graphic autopsy photos. Dummett denied it. They wound up prying open, they got a search warrant, they pried open Dummett's desk, they found the photos. He just lied about that. Yeah. Robert Harris, a guy who's I think in his 80s, I took his deposition. He said Dummett tried to frame him for a big robbery in 1970, just tried to pin it on him out of the blue. This Dummett was a bad, bad dude. And he is the ringleader here in the Chester Weaker case. So,
right. He had the nickname Dustpan Dummett because he'd go find evidence in the dustpan somehow, right? He was known for just making it happen.
He'd clean up any little mess. Like if there was a trial going on and the state didn't have a certain piece of evidence, Dummett would come and testify and say, oh, he'd conveniently hear us something, say something, claim somebody admitted something, some nonsense. Unbelievable. So I got one more thing to talk about, and I thought this was interesting too. This person also found an article about the husbands. Now, you know, when we started down this trail, once we heard the evidence from Roy Tyson, Miss Smith, you know, about one of the husbands wanting their wife killed, we figured out that Frances Murphy had these unique injuries, her fingertips missing. She's got soiled clothing. She's got vaginal bruising. We started to think, well, gosh, Robert Murphy sure seems like, you know, he could be the person they're talking about. This is an article from August 22nd, 1960, Whitney. This is just a few months after the murders. Okay. And it's called Spiking a False Rumor in Starved Rock. And it said, there is absolutely no truth to a recently circulated rumor that the husband of one of the three women mysteriously murdered 6 months ago in a canyon at Starved Rock State Park has remarried. And then it goes on to quote the reverend at the Presbyterian Church in Riverside, who said there's no truth to this, that, his quote was, "Most emphatically, may I tell you, there is nothing at all to the rumor you mentioned. Each of these families are very close to the church, and the husbands are with us in worship regularly each Sunday." But this is my point. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
That there was a rumor in August of 1960, so much so that a local pastor wrote a letter to the pastor in Riverside asking about it, and then they had to come out with this op-ed in the paper to try to quench it. I mean, so like, it's not just you and I speculating here.
Right.
This was
right.
Pretty prevalent back in the day, which I had no idea.
Yeah. I mean, and there was no truth to it. Maybe that person might regret saying that if they had known that, you know, just less than 2 years after the murders, there would be that marriage between Mr. Murphy and Marion. His then second, longtime second wife who bore him a child who was born 2 months before the murders, mind you.
Right. January of 1960. So I also want to give one last update.
I don't know, Andy.
Oh, Whitney, I know.
I'm exasperated.
Oh, me too. Exasperated is not even the right word. I mean, exasperated in like your biggest font, all bold, all caps. But the next court date is April 10th. What'll happen then, so people understand this, the post-conviction process is three stages. Stage one, we filed our petition asking the court to accept it. The court reviewed it and felt we had met our burden, so it goes to the second stage. Will County has now claimed, trying to dismiss it, claiming either our evidence is not new or it's not material, which means it's not significant and wouldn't really have changed the, potentially changed the trial result. So I filed a response to that. I'm going to post it on the podcast website. I think their arguments are weak. I don't think it's going to fly. April 10th, we'll argue that in court. We'll have oral argument on that motion. I don't think the judge will rule that day. It'd be great if he did, but you know, there's a lot to digest. If the motion's denied, which I know some of our evidence is going to survive, we'll go to step three. Stage three is the final stage where it's basically an evidentiary hearing. It's a trial. We'll put on our evidence. We'll put on all our evidence. And what you do is you compare that evidence to the trial evidence. And the judge will decide if we've met our burden. And if we have, the conviction can get vacated. So we're actually getting close. And I want to stress this. When you compare, and I talk about this in our legal brief, and I'll post it. People can read it for the people that really want to take a deep dive. You've got to compare the new evidence to the trial evidence. And I cited a lot of cases where courts found that the new evidence could potentially change the trial result, noted that there was no physical or forensic evidence linking to the person of the crime. That's what we have here. There's nothing forensically linking Chester to the crime. No physical evidence, no forensic evidence. It's based on his confession. The case the state presented in 1961 was so weak, Whitney. This case would not even get charged today, let alone tried. It was so weak. And that's why in that 2010 Illinois Continuing Legal Education seminar, there was a DVD, a video I watched. Tony Reculia, the prosecutor, admitted that's exactly why they only tried Chester for the murder of Lillian Odin, because they were worried that the confession would be found to be involuntary, would be barred, because Tony Reculia said he wasn't surprised there was a confession based on how much pressure Dubbett and Hess exerted on Chester. And that if Chester was acquitted, they wanted to try to charge him, you know, have trial number two on one of the other murders. That's how weak it was, Whitney. It was a weak case. I saw another article, and I posted this as an exhibit to my brief. It quoted a jury foreman back in the day saying the first vote was 7-5 guilty. Vote number two was 6-6. I mean, this is in 1960 when society had no idea the concept of false confessions. It was a not, I mean, we just learned about this in the last, 10 years, really. You know, now we understand the science behind it, the factors that lead to it, you know, why it happens. In 1960, nobody knew about any of this. The case in 1960 was weak. And if all these things that we have found were used at that trial, the hair DNA result, the genetic genealogy result, what the telephone operator overheard about the brothers, the twine being cut in two different places, the twine being 20 strand and 10 strand, the lodge had no 10 strand twine, Chester Weger's house had no 10 strand twine. I mean, I can go on and on and on like you and I have talked about ad nauseum. It'd be a tsunami of defense evidence. So,
and what more evidence was there possibly in 1960 that we now just don't even have access to,
interviews
with people or, I mean,
we're missing a ton.
Yeah. There's so much missing.
I mean, I can tell you things offhand. We have the interview of Glenn Palmateer. That was in the Steve Stout documents. Thank God we found that. That was huge. There was also an interview of William Palmateer. We don't have that. Now see, Glenn may not have made that call, as we've talked about. I think the call was made by Lupe Cardenas because of the way Lois Zelensek described the voice. You know, she said a big, burly guy, uneducated, the way he spoke. But what's William Palmateer going to say? The call was placed to his house. He clearly answered the phone. All he could say is, we didn't talk about that, okay? which is nonsense. They clearly talked about it. And Will County, by the way, says in their brief, oh, they deny that the murders the brothers were talking about on that call were the Stavrock murders. Give me a break. Oh, there sure was a big write-up in tonight's paper about the murders. Oh, were they talking about some other murder? You know?
Some other crime of the century?
Yeah, there's, you know, and putting aside a polygraph, you know, they gave polygraphs to these brothers and then they vanished. A polygraph is not the end of the story ever, as we've talked about. There should be all kinds of interviews and investigation of these brothers, Lupe Cardenas as well. I've seen lots of documents talking about tips. There should be hundreds and hundreds of memos documenting tips. We don't have any of that. We're missing a ton of stuff. I even saw articles saying, you know, hundreds of guys were getting fingerprinted. I've seen no documents about fingerprints. Apparently they recovered, there was some talk about a bloody fingerprint on the stockings of one of the ladies, and they were going to do fingerprinting. I've seen no documents about that. That's a huge gap. So I wish we could go back in time and have the entire file. And Chester was not provided with any discovery. He didn't have any of these documents. He went to trial with nothing. So, anywho, let's end on a positive note. Despite all this, despite the frustration, despite the exasperation, the brick wall that, you know, has been put up, Whitney, I also want to stress how important it is for us right now to try to reach out to anybody out there who may be alive. Like, you know, we found out that Louis Getch, the Justice of the Peace, is still alive, 95 years old. I'll give another example. Arnold Daly, do you remember that name? Was a truck driver.
Yeah, I remember that.
By he the was, park, yeah. And he saw the women like on the side of the road, you know, and you know, maybe talking to some other people, like a guy in a car. So I was just alerted like a week ago that Mr. Daly is alive and lives in Oglesby. And I was actually going to go out and see him today, the day we're recording this. And then I was notified, and I'm looking at his obituary. He passed last Thursday, March 7th, 84 years old. Can you believe that? That broke my heart. I was so, so looking forward to talking to him to see what he remembered about what he saw. You know, think of all the things he could have told us. What he saw, he could have told us about Dummett and Hess and the investigation and rumors, what he heard. Oh my gosh.
First, Arnold I'm Daly. So sorry to his family. I'm so sorry for his loss. And then secondly, every time a person dies, it's the loss of a person, surely, but it's the loss of a database of information, right? It's the loss of an untold amount of information that could be helpful. And so it's just,
you're right. It's like all the personal knowledge and memories pass with the person.
It's a hard drive you can't recover, right? Yeah. That's it's the frustrating part. It's a hard drive you can't hack into.
And so I really want to urge people out there, if you know anybody that may know something, especially that older generation, you know, people in their 80s and above, please reach out to them. Please talk to them. Please reach out to me. You know, it's hard to reach those people, Whitney, right? Because, you know, they're just probably not as likely on our podcast Facebook page or listening to a podcast. Maybe they are, but, you know, like my 89-year-old mom, you know, she's not on social media. She's not listening to podcasts. You know, she's watching TV, bless her heart. So I would love to talk to Mr. Daly, but if anybody out there knows him or his family, we'd like to talk to them, any family members. So we're getting close. We're going to have this court hearing on April 10th. I'm so looking forward to this oral argument. I believe we'll get to a third stage with some of our evidence. I think the bulk of our evidence, and we'll continue to investigate. And so anybody out there, please, if you know anything about the Bray brothers, if you know anything about anything with the Stavrock murder, if you know any old timers out there that might know something, reach out to them or give me their contact information. You can remain anonymous. Point me in the right direction. We are still investigating. You can go to the podcast website and contact me there. You can email me directly at andy@hailmonaco.com as well. We need your help. We need your help. We're getting so close. So any last words, Whitney, before we sign off?
I feel like there has to be a changing of the guard in Will County. I'm so frustrated by this situation because it just feels like I made the joke. No matter what, you know, what evidence you come up with, they're going to come back and be like, oh, it's a Russian deep state fake. It's a deep fake and we're not going to accept it. And I'm just going to go to bed tonight and say my prayers that there's going to be some sort of change of heart at Will County. That's all I have to say today, I think.
Well, and I'll remind people, you know, anybody that didn't listen to the last episode, go back and listen to the last episode where I talk about some of the forensic discovery we want to do that Will County is opposed to. Testing that wood fragment to see if it came from a baseball bat. Testing that clump, those locks and curls of hair to see if they were cut like with scissors or a knife. And that red fuzz found at the crime scene. Will County's opposed it. But now here's the thing. They opposed it saying it didn't fit under that DNA statute like I talked about. Now that my post-conviction petition has reached the second stage, the court has discretion to allow a party to conduct discovery. So I'm asking the court for permission to conduct that, to have MicroTrace do those non-destructive microscopic examinations of the wood fragment, the hair, and the red fuzz. And I'm also asking the court to give me permission to take the deposition of the Justice of the Peace, Lois, I guess it's pronounced Louis Getch is what I'm told.
Oh, it's Getch.
And then polygraph examiner Stephen Kindig. I'd like to sit down with them under oath, take our time, and ask some questions. So that's all going to come up on April 10th, too. I've asked Will County if they, I just emailed them today and asked them if they're opposed to that or not. I haven't heard back, so I'll keep you posted. But, you know, as I said before, trace evidence can be so powerful in figuring out a crime scene. You know, it's not just DNA evidence. Trace evidence, fibers, fragments, things found at a crime scene can offer a lot of clues. And so I'm hoping we can continue with our trace evidence examination. So we're not stopping, Whitney. We got the momentum. We're like a snowball going down the hill. I don't care what anybody else says or thinks. They can put anything on Facebook like this person saying, wasn't these brothers. Okay, whatever. We got to just keep our eyes focused, eye on the prize, keep plowing forward. So that's the episode. Stay tuned. Hope to have an update soon. Stay in touch. And again, if you know anything about the case, please reach out.
And specifically, if you know anything about Edward Simon Bray, we want to know everything we can about him.
Yes. I'm your host, Andy Hale. This is along with Whitney Braun. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the support. Tons of support from people. Thank you so much. This episode was produced by Phineas Ellis and Studio Friends, design and promotion by Bell and Ivy. I'm your host, Andy Hale. We will see you soon. Stay tuned.